And thanks, Lauren, for letting us see how to overcome some shame that a bunch of us deal with. So well done, good and faithful servant. And thanks for sharing your story and sharing your smile. And you haven't shared your shimmy yet today, but that's okay. I got enough other places to see it.
Only if you'll do it with me.
Welcome to The Aggressive Life. Fall is right around the corner, or actually upon us, depending on where you live and what the temperature is. I love fall. I love fall because fall has my favorite sport. Fall equals football to me. I love it. More time spending watching TV than I normally may. More time, well, not for me, but maybe for you. More money you're gambling on whatever site or fantasy or whatever it is. It's just, there's a love affair that we have with the game of football, which I think is kind of cool. Kind of is something that brings us together. Well, if that is you, you may know my guest today. You may have seen her in her trademark shimmy on the sideline with ESPN, Lauren Sisler. She's got a book that's called Shatterproof, How I Overcame the Shame of Losing My Parents to Opioid Addiction and Found My Sideline Shimmy. She's got some stuff to pour into us. And hey, let's talk to this woman today. Her name is Lauren Sisler!
Brian.
Yes.
That might be the best introduction I've received in a very long time, if ever.
People don't have any fun anymore. Yes, people don't have energy anymore. You're giving up your time to come on a podcast. The least I can do is give you an energetic intro.
The energy. You were popping off, my friend. Woo! Let's go! Hey, I love it. I'm glad that you're enthusiastic because it is fall. I live here in Alabama, so you kind of mentioned the temperatures. Actually, believe it or not, I went for a stroll this morning and it felt like fall. I was playing tennis last night and it felt like fall. I'm like, ooh, it really might be, it might just be fall.
Yeah, I know. Same up here in Cincinnati. It is nipply. It is nice. It's like beautiful for being, oh, did I just say nipply? Nipply. I could say that.
I don't know. I guess.
What's my podcast? Actually, I can say whatever I want on my podcast. Yes.
Lauren
my
didn't
podcast. Like, I don't
she
know.
Didn't
I'm
care.
Just going to roll with it. Just go with it.
But you've got quite a background. You're a gymnast. Were you a cheerleader at any time?
No. No cheerleader, dude. I mean, obviously, I am the loudest one in the room, typically. I cheer a lot. You know, I'm outwardly energetic. But no, gymnastics was always my sport. So, you know, I stuck with it, obviously did it through college, and I'm grateful for it. My body, on the other hand, is probably not so grateful for it, but here we are.
Yeah, my wife was a big gymnast. She had hopes and aspirations to walk on at Ohio State, and then she completely blew out her knee in last year of high school. And that was the time when, you know, ACL surgeries are certainly not what they are today or anything. So
yeah
she we know a bit about the difficulty with the gymnastic world and also just the grind. Like, do you have kids?
I do. I have a 2-year-old son. He just turned 2 July 4th.
So do you have any opinions? Would you have your kids go through gymnastics or not?
Well, you know, I get that question often. So I will say this. I'll preface it by saying I am 5'9". My husband is in the 6'2", 6'3" range. Our son is already in the 93rd percentile for height. So, you know, and I will say this. In women's gymnastics, like, the average height is about 5 foot. So I'm like, way over my mark. In men's gymnastics, I will say they still tend to have a smaller center of gravity. I went and covered the NCAA men's championship, and I still felt like I towered over many of the guys competing.
They love
you know,
that.
But Here we are. But as far as the sport, you know, it's kind of like, I get that same question about football, right? Because I'm around football all the time. And, you know, I think I'm kind of under that mindset of like, let's just see where they go. Like, I don't want to push. I don't want to push him in one direction or another. But I do want to introduce him to all the things. And if he falls in love with it, then so be it. Let's let her rip. We'll see how it goes.
I have zero qualms about any of my kids or grandkids playing football. My perspective is very, very, very low risk at that age and at any age until you get maybe in the college pro level. I have zero, but like the gymnast thing, body image, pushing, you're never good enough, you're not perfect enough, all that, that's a tough one for me.
It is tough. And I will say, you know, I am very grateful that I grew up in a gym and an atmosphere and with parents that never really pushed the body image thing. I think sometimes, you know, I was probably harder on myself more than anything. But that was never an issue for me. I love food and I still love food and I still indulge whenever I'm so pleased. And so I will say that the food thing has never been an issue for me, the body image. But I have seen so many gymnasts that have dealt with it on every level, at the lower levels, upper levels. And obviously, it is that's a challenge for sure. And, you know, you just never want your kids to start to create that body dysmorphia, right? Because obviously it's something that you end up carrying with you for potentially life. And so,
it may be different today too, because back in when Lib was doing it, we weren't as politically correct. And some of the political correctness based on where you are in the political spectrum is good. We weren't as politically correct back when, and coaches would just tell her, man, you're too fat. Just tell her that, oh, man, if only you had lost, if only you were 5 pounds less. You know, you little girl, when you hear that from somebody like a coach, authority figure, that jacks up your mind, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's tough. I mean, and to be that small and to be that little and to be told, like you said, and I think that's where the sport can be difficult, because number one, it's a very individual sport, unlike other sports. So it's you, yourself, and you, and you're out there competing, doing each and every apparatus. But then on top of that, it does become the perfect 10, right? The spectrum of the perfect 10. How do you achieve that perfect 10? And that then starts to infiltrate every part of your life. I mean, I for sure was the, you know, everything had that bar was set, you know, perfect 10. And then it's the deduction. So you start to deduct, not even in the sport, but in life. It's like the little deductions that you start to take in your life that can definitely start to weigh you down. So you have to get your mind right and keep the right support system around you to avoid the pitfalls that can come with obviously the sport of gymnastics, but many other sports where you see kids really get, right, you know, involved and they have a love for the sport. But when it's no longer a passion and a love, you know, a love story, that's when you start to have to reevaluate.
What was your path to ESPN and sideline reporting?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I actually wanted to be a sports doctor. That was always my goal. Growing up as a child, that was my childhood dream, right? So as an athlete, having many setbacks, dealing with all the injuries, I thought, well, this would be a great opportunity to help athletes get back out on the field of play. I thought, like, I have empathy, you know? But unfortunately, and I know we'll dive more into the story, but I get to college and, have to deal with quite a few things. And the grades started slipping, and we'll just call a spade a spade. A 2.0 GPA ain't getting me into med school, my friends. So that's when I realized, like, oh, that childhood dream, we might need to reevaluate. And it's actually funny because my Uncle Mike was an ER doc, and he's since retired, but, you know, always value his opinion on things. And I remember being so fearful when I decided, okay, we're not doing sports medicine. Let's go in a different direction. And my teammate at Rutgers when I was competing there as a gymnast was doing sports broadcasting. And she said, you would be good at this. Like, you love to perform, you love sports, you're high energy. And so when I decided to make the change, y'all, I was literally terrified to call my family, to call my aunt and uncle and say, hey, so I think I'm going to go in a different direction. And my Uncle Mike, literally, like the realest number cruncher that he is, he's like, you know, I'm really glad that you're making this decision, because I just don't know that you'd ever be able to get your GPA in a position to get you in med school. I mean, it was like a real talk. And I was like, okay, here we go. So,
well, 2.0 at Rutgers is a lot different than 2.0 where I went to school. I'll tell you that much right now.
Where'd you go to school?
I kept transferring to places until I could find a solid C someplace. I started off at Geneva College and went to Robbie Bobby Moe, now known as Robert Morris University.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that school that used to get in the NCAA tournament. And then at the first half, they'd be down by 1 point to North Carolina or Indiana in the first round. And then, of course, they get crushed. It was good times. So,
Yes. Look, hey, you know, I've had my fair share. We were 1-11 my freshman year at Rutgers, okay?
Man.
But we worked our way up, and, you know, we're becoming relevant again. You know, we've transitioned over to the Big Ten, which has helped for sure.
Yeah.
To give us, a little bit more money to buy the facilities and, you know, as people will say it today, buy the players, you know?
I tell you what, the college thing is a whole nother deal. There had to be something that changed for those players. Those players had to get some money. Everyone else was getting money. This is a capitalistic country. Why can't somebody who's 19 participate in capitalism? All that's true. Yes. And I just have zero interest in college sports now. I'm not interested in college football or college basketball. And I guess I'll watch the tournament or something like that, but it's just not the same. And I got to think that's going to affect the NCAA financially as well. Because there's a lot of people.
Yeah,
like
I try not to get too in the weeds on the decision-making process. I know that they've started this commission to help with some of these decisions. But I'll be honest, it is different. And I will say this.
You feel it when you're on field. You feel the difference.
I do feel a difference. Mm. I definitely feel a difference. And I will say pros and cons, and maybe more specifically as a reporter in my role. The pros being that, you know, these kids tend to want to talk more. They want to be a little bit more personality. And for me on the sidelines, like, you have kids that are actually like kind of putting themselves out there because the world now sees them. And obviously they know they can monetize that. So there's that part of it, which is fun, because I feel like the players and stuff are becoming a little more human, so to speak. But and the other positive, I will say, has benefited not so much your tier one sports like your footballs and your basketballs, gymnastics. You could not be on a Wheaties box and then go compete in college. Like, that was not allowed. That was not a thing. Like, and think about it. You know, a lot of these gymnasts peak at 16, 17 years old. Olympics are over. Now what? Well, they couldn't go to college and continue their career because Olympics are up here and then college is down here in terms of level and difficulty. And so it's kind of the natural transition for a gymnast to go hit the pinnacle, do the Olympics, and then go have fun doing college gymnastics. And that didn't exist. And so I do love that that has helped out some of those, you know, sports that aren't necessarily revenue generating sports. But I will say, then on the flip side, you do just have, I mean, when I start doing my preparation for a game, having to figure out like the mathematics and figuring out like a kid is a redshirt junior and this is like his fourth school. And I'm like, how is this possible? Like, how did we get here? You know, so of course, NIL and transfer portal, I think, obviously go hand in hand. And I think between the two of those, there's a lot to unpack. And obviously, I think that, I think that some guardrails are going to have to go up if we want to see a change. Because like you said, Brian, it's definitely become more of a pro-like atmosphere and free agency, and there's just no guardrails. So it's just like free-for-all. Everyone called it the Wild Wild West, and it has certainly become that.
Yeah. I don't think they necessarily have to change. That's the way you want to run your business and probably needs to do it. That's fine. I'm just saying voice of one, and I think the viewership statistics are going to bear this out this year. They're just going to be a decline. I can get pros anywhere. These are just younger pros. No big deal.
Yeah, that's a good point. It'll be interesting to see because we do see the ratings and the viewership. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how that plays out.
To your point of the transfer portal, you just – whatever your favorite college is, Michigan, Ohio State on the extreme opposites, USC, like these are just individual hired gun gladiators that aren't really a Trojan. They aren't a Buckeye. I haven't been developing with these people. There's just going to be less attachment the fans have to the program. All you're really cheering for is the literal colors, because you don't even know the players. You can't keep up with them.
You don't know them. And I will say, so the COVID thing kind of got wonky for a while, because you're seeing kids that are literally like 7 years, playing for 7 years. Seriously, wow. This is wild. But then I think now, and it's just an odd place to be. When I do player interviews, I'm usually kind of taken aback when I talk to a kid that's been there 3 years, 4 years with zero transfers, because the percentage of kids that haven't transferred is so low now.
Right.
And I feel like that, you know, those are the kids that should be rewarded. And I don't think that's always the case, because it's like, you know, who's going to go out there and compete and win us games? The kids that are sticking around, being loyal, sitting the bench, waiting their turn. I think that's a big part of it. And I mean, I even remember Nick Saban talking about this, you know, prior to his retirement. I always thought Nick Saban, you know, was a guy that was going to retire when his health told him it's time to retire. But for him to make that decision, and for the record, I did an event with him a couple weeks ago, the Nick Saban Legacy Award. I've done this a few years with him. Different guy.
Is he?
Happy. You can just tell, like the weight of the world has just, like, you know?
Wow.
He loves to golf and all that stuff, but you just see a different guy. His smile, everything about him, you can just tell he's alleviated some of that stress. And he said prior to retirement, as things were starting to shift, you know, when you've got a five-star athlete that has to sit on the bench and you've got to tell them to sit on the bench because they got to wait their turn, like, a five-star athlete's never sat on the bench a day in their life since 3 years old. And he said these kids just don't know how to take it, and they don't know how to navigate that. They don't know how to, you know, understand that you're going to have to work and earn your position, and now is not the time.
Yes. Well, and that was one of the reasons he stated that he was getting out of the game. The game had just changed. He didn't want to deal with basically being a pro GM and that stress. And there'll never be another like him. Boy, that's a dream. That's a dream. Derek, we got to get him in the podcast.
Are you that good?
Are you that good?
Maybe Lauren can help us.
Yeah, I know. Now we got it in. We've got Nick Saban's best buddy.
Man, come on.
No problem.
Yeah, we might have to strong arm a few of his agents, but maybe we'll see what we can do.
There you go. Dirt will just bat his eyelashes at him. He'll be happy. All right. So what I'm really fascinated by, Lauren, is the juxtaposition between your sideline shimmy, which is what many people know you for, and you can YouTube it and everything, and how that relates to your pain point in your past. Talk about that for us.
It's good. The sideline shimmy, you know, it's something that's became, I guess you could say, a little viral.
For sure.
Here's the quick and dirty on it. People always ask, do you still get nervous when you go on TV? Yeah, of course I do. I get nervous when I go on TV. I get nervous when I go up on stage, you know, and have to talk to, even if it's 50 people or 2,000 people, whatever it is, of course I get nervous. And I think a lot of that is, first of all, I've started to understand the nerves are good. I don't hate the nerves, because it reminds me where I'm at, keeps me grounded, and helps me to realize, like, that I'm in a very unique position, and I need to relish in that, and I need to be in it and not take it for granted. So the nerves would set in, and I would literally have microphone in hand, and it was like, I knew exactly what I wanted to say. I was confident. I did my research. I did all my prep. Life is good. And then it's like, they're counting me in 5, 4, 3, 2, you're live. And all of a sudden it was like, you know? And so I was like, okay, we got to do something about this. So it was like this idea, by the way, I used to be a DJ, DJ Sizzla, wiki wiki. So music is my thing. I love music and I love dancing. I'm not saying I'm a good dancer, but I love to dance. And so just moving my body and dancing to the music in the stadium when the big board's playing and the guys are warming up and everyone's getting ready for the big game, it's a way to help me to simmer the nerves down. So that's really how it was born, because I used to dance on the sidelines, not realizing cameras are always rolling. All the cameras are always rolling hours before kickoff. So I always warn people, if you're in the stadium and you want to do something stupid, just know the cameras are watching you at all times, even if it's 3 hours before kickoff. And so I posted this silly video of me dancing before a football game. I was getting ready. And so it just kind of went viral, and then it just became a thing. And so you talk about the pain point, right? So the sideline shimmy to me is joyful. It's happy. It's silly. You know, it shows that a part of my personality that is really fully me, who I am. And then, you peel back the layers and you realize there is pain, and there's been a journey of pain that has led me down that path to finding that joy again. And that pain point really goes back to my freshman year at Rutgers, when I lost both of my parents within 5 hours of each other.
It's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. I was reading that it was an accidental drug overdose, and yet they were oxy addicts. Is that right?
So basically, they were going to a pain management doctor. And mind you, I'm at Rutgers, 8 hours away. Yeah. My brother's stationed in the military. He's about three and a half hours from home. So we're out of the house at this point. My parents were going to a pain management doctor for 3 or 4 years while I was still in high school. You know, so they would go to this pain management doctor. My mom had degenerative disc disease. Dad had chronic back pain, PTSD from his service in the military. So they were going to a doctor being told, here's some medication that's going to help you. And it did start off with OxyContin. And they were taking the OxyContin as prescribed. Eventually, the OxyContin wasn't working anymore for my mom. She couldn't manage it. And so the doctor said, let's try the fentanyl pain patch. So then he prescribed her that. And that's like a time release. You know, wear it somewhere, you know, on your body that releases into the body, the bloodstream, on a time release form. And eventually prescribed 72 hours. Well, this isn't working anymore. Let's do 48 hours. And so again, it was this chain of events that was culminating, right? This isn't working. Let's try this. This isn't working. Let's try this. And it just compounded. And eventually, after about three or four years of them taking this medication, what was working at one point, they were no longer just taking it for their chronic pain. They were now taking it for being, you know, for right. the dope sick, for right. being, you know, addicted to their drugs. And so that chronic pain then turned into being dope sick, that then turned into them abusing the medication because it was the only thing that could get them out of bed in the morning to put a smile on their face, to function, to go to work, to put, you know, put food on the table for their family, to provide for us. Yeah. And it's just sad because I think the hardest part of it, Brian, is that this happened all behind closed doors in silence. Nobody saw it coming.
It is an insidious thing. I have someone who's pretty close with me who has got some addiction issues with this thing, and it's a deal where it's like the body becomes addicted and wants it so much that the body tells the mind, "Hey, send some pain signals. We need our fix." Like, tell our buddy here, tell our host here that we're really hurt. We need more of that stuff. And so you convince yourself, or your body's convinced, I need, well, it's the addiction's kicked in. It's insidious and horrible.
I mean, it's just like, you know, the necessities that we need, you know, water, food, sleep, like those things are necessary for our bodies. And when you become addicted to a substance, it then becomes necessary because your body thinks that it needs that to function. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get that, you get extremely sick. And I will say this, I've never personally walked through addiction to a substance. Let's be real. I mean, like, I'm obsessed with Coke Zero. Everybody experiences like an addiction somewhere or something that they're just like drawn to. But this is when your body actually rewires itself. And you then become so reliant on that thing that if you don't get that thing, the alternative is extremely painful. And in many times, and this is what, when I've talked to other addicts, those also in recovery, you know, have said that they would rather lose their life or take their life than to not have the drug. That is how powerful it is. And when you talk to these individuals, and even my parents, two people that literally had it all together on the outside, you know, my dad had a great job, worked 16 years at the Salem VA. My mom was part-time working because she took care of my brother and I as we were walking through our sports and, you know, school and all the things. She didn't want us to be in childcare. And so she did the part-time work, you know, mom thing. And on the outside, we were like the white picket fence family, you know, or at least in my mind, I thought we had the white picket fence, you know.
Right.
And yet, you know, for the earlier part of our lives, for the most part, we did. But I will say there was still struggles. You know, my parents had little bouts of struggles with finances throughout, you know, the early part of their marriage. And then, you know, as we were growing to be, you know, teens. But then also, too, my dad struggled with alcoholism. So that was there. And that was there all along. And that was something that was known to our family, and we recognized it. But then when you added the layer of the prescription drug addiction to it, that just became so quiet. And it was a battle that they fought really hard, but behind closed doors where they were not willing to ask for help. And I think that is where shame bears down on us and tells us, you go sit in the corner in the darkness. Don't come out in the light with this.
Yeah. But they died hours apart from each other. How does that happen? And it's accidental?
Yeah. Huh. So, you know, I think that's always like kind of the big question. And you understand, Brian, for years, first of all, I wouldn't share the truth. Right. I didn't even uncover the truth of what happened to them because I refused to go there because of the shame that I felt that, oh, my parents had a problem with medication, addiction, like this, no, like they can't be addicts, nuh-uh. And so I literally spent much of my life, you know, the years after they passed away, running away from that. So then coming full circle, decades later, finally uncovering the truth of what does that mean, accidental overdoses? And mom dies, and 5 hours later, dad dies. Like, that sparks a lot of questions for a lot of people, right? Right. This just doesn't make sense. This doesn't add up. So, you know, being able to kind of uncover that and discover really the truth of what happened, because mind you, we had a 3-paragraph report from the call center that essentially took the call when my dad found my mom dead. Mm. 3 paragraphs to go off of to understand what the heck happened. 3 paragraphs, that's it. And none of it made sense. And so thankfully, after a long journey into healing, I finally decided to go there to figure some stuff out. And number one, to see the toxicology reports and acknowledge that my parents both died of fentanyl overdoses. And then the second part of that was to better understand the why, the how, and really uncover the events that happened that night, because I wasn't there. My brother wasn't there. We had no idea. We had no idea what happened. And so what the discovery process told us, and this really went into writing my book, Shatterproof, you know, being able to tell as much detail as possible, answering as many questions as possible, was that my mom essentially put the fentanyl patch that she had in the freezer, sucked on the fentanyl patch to get high. It will put you into respiratory failure if you take too much. That is the direct side effect of an overdose. And she had gone out on the porch, I guess, to either catch her breath or to cool off. We don't know, obviously, the exact reason she was found outside on the porch, But my dad woke up in the middle of the night. He always fell asleep on the couch. That was like the usual thing for him. And then he'd get up and go to the bedroom. Well, when he went to the bedroom, mom wasn't there. So he starts looking around the room. Mom's nowhere to be found, not in the house. He goes outside, finds mom on the porch, slumped over. And she had essentially taken the fentanyl patch to get high, to feel better, to alleviate the pain. And, you know, unfortunately, she aspirated on it and died.
Put it in the freezer, like then she used it as a popsicle kind of thing. Said she sucked on it.
Yeah. So essentially, you know, with any drug, you can alter the way it's taken, right? You can crush it, you can snort it, you can inject it. Like there's many different ways that people, you know, are able to, you know, consume a drug. And obviously, you know, putting it in your bloodstream is the quickest way to get the effects from it, right? And it did exactly what it was supposed to, which is, you know, for my mom, you know, to give her the fix that she needed. Because at this point, and this is what I'm assuming, so I saw my parents in February. They came to Rutgers to visit me, and nothing, you know, nothing really seemed off. You know, I just knew they were in a lot of pain. I knew finances weren't in great shape, but like no indication that there was any sort of major dysfunction happening. Nothing that really sent any signals to me that like, hey, something's really wrong. And so, you know, I don't know how long my parents had been abusing the medication, but I would imagine it had been several months at this point. And I don't know if that's the first time my mom had done that. My dad overdosed at Thanksgiving, the first Thanksgiving I was home from Rutgers. And he, you know, we actually woke up that morning to my mom screaming, someone call 911. My dad was on the couch, blue, barely breathing. So we, you know, called 911. We went to the hospital. He survived. Close call, but he survived. And he literally told my mom, and my grandparents were there too. I was not in the room. He told them that he read online that you could take the fentanyl patch, put it in the freezer, suck on it, and get high. And he said it did exactly what it said it would do. And so this all happened at Thanksgiving of 2022. So we're talking November 2022. They die March of 2023. So at this point, we've already gotten to the progression of being 100% addicted, need help, someone call for help, right? And so, you know, when my dad had found my mom, so going back to that night, March 24th of 2003, you know, actually early in the morning, my dad found my mom, and then he called 911, he gets them there, and at this point, she's already gone. And then he goes to the hospital to take care of things, and I think they felt like, you know, they knew that he was going back home and he had two kids that had to get home. So he was trying to get me home from Rutgers, trying to get my brother who was stationed in Norfolk, Virginia home. You know, he had to put in all his leave and everything else to leave base. And he's on the phone and suddenly he collapses and the woman on the other end heard him collapse, heard his loud breathing, and knew something was wrong. So she immediately called the sheriff's department in our city, in our town, and notified them. And when the sheriff and the deputy got there, he was already gone.
Man. So you used the phrase journey of healing, and shame is the title of your book. Shame, like shame, your parents having that happen to you impacted your personal identity. You felt like there was a scarlet letter on your chest. What was that like?
Yeah, definitely the scarlet letter, because the shame piece of it, society tells us what addiction looks like, who it impacts. We love to throw labels on people, right? We do it all the time. Ooh, let's throw labels on this and that. Like we love to put people in a box and you know, assume that because they're an addict, they must be bad people. Oh, you know? And so then I felt like I was carrying that scarlet letter because my parents, to me, in my eyes were, I put them on a pedestal first and foremost, but you know, they were very loving and compassionate people, very involved in our athletics, our lives, very involved in the community. and just overall happy people. And I think for me, knowing that they died from addiction then suddenly kind of tarnishes the Sizzler reputation in my mind.
In your mind. Right? It doesn't, I don't think, but in your mind it does. And that's why you need some healing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it tarnished, and that is why I spent years and years and years. My best friend in the whole world didn't know for 7 years how my parents died.
Wow.
Because I could not speak the truth. I went back to Rutgers telling the sugar-coated story. Mom died of respiratory failure. Dad died of a heart attack. Like, wouldn't you say, like, if someone said that to you, you'd be like, huh. But you probably wouldn't question it. You'd just be like, oh, wow.
Wait, you said they died in 23.
No, 2003.
2003. I was going to say, okay, I got it. Yeah,
did I say 2023?
I thought you did. Yeah.
Maybe I did. I don't know. Yeah, you did. It has been 22 years since they passed away. Am I doing the math right? Or 23 years? Are we at, 22 years.
22.
So 22 years since they passed away, yeah. And
not bad for 2.0. 2.0, you added that up pretty good.
I know. I did the math. Oh, gosh. Well, unfortunately, I've been on this journey for a very long time.
Right.
And, you know, the idea of this healing journey, you know, because I did have to unpack a lot. And there was a lot tied to, you know, why did this happen? Why did mom and dad have so much medication? Why were they in so much pain? Why were they taking so much medication to help with that pain? Why did they never ask for help? I mean, there were so many questions. And then it's the anger sets in of, you know, why did this happen? And why me? Why my family? And then why did nobody ask for help? Why didn't I ask more questions? Why didn't I do more to help them? Like, you start manifesting all these things. And I just knew, like, all right, you know, something's got to change here, because I started to just feel myself inside on the outside. You know, you said it when I jumped on this call, you're like, ooh, you got the energy, girl. Well, I've always had that kind of energy, but there was a point in my life where for a very long time, internally, I was just battling the truth. I was wrestling with the truth, and I did not want to put that truth into the light because I felt like I was going to be judged and shamed for it, just as my parents were, and their legacy was bound in my hands, and it was up to me to preserve it at all costs.
Most of the time when somebody is an abuser of substances or an addict to substances, the people around them bear the brunt. The people around them are caught up in the whirlwind and the chaos and all of that stuff. So I would have to think that there was a level of chaos that your parents were creating for your life, that I wonder if when they died, a part of you didn't go like, I'm off the crazy train. And that probably brought more pain and guilt and shame. Like, what am I doing thinking about this? Did any of that happen with you?
Well, I'll be honest with you. That would normally, I think, be the case. And I know this because of addiction and what it does to families.
Yeah.
I think that certainly could have played into it. But I think because I was so oblivious, Brian, like oblivious.
Wow, interesting.
So I went to Rutgers. Okay. I'm living my life, living my dream. I mentioned they came to visit. I got a call from my mom about a week before before her and my dad passed away. And she was furious. And my mom like never got mad. My mom was a straight shooter. She'd call it like it is, but she never like got furious, angry, mad, unless something was really bothering her. And she called me and she says, you're not going back to Rutgers next year. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, you know, I'm on scholarship here. I've got 3 more years. So we can't afford to keep you there. So mind you, I was on a scholarship, but not a full ride. Rutgers didn't have full rides at the time because of the funding. So they were still having to pay for school and take out student loans. And not to mention, I still got to live, right? You know, like food and housing and all the things. And she was furious. And I was like, well, what did I do? And I will say in some ways I did take the brunt of it and take the heat on it and think, oh my gosh, like I've contributed to my parents' financial disarray. Like, this is my fault. Oh my gosh. Like, what have I done?
Oh, right.
And, sheesh, you know, at this point, my parents were struggling financially. At this point, I did not know it. They had mentioned it, but apparently they were trying to sell our house, the house that my parents built, their dream home out in the country. They were trying to sell it because they knew they needed the money and they needed to consolidate and basically figure out how to financially get back in the green because they had been in the red for so long. But unbeknownst to me, like, my parents are stroking $10 checks to the power company. Like, I didn't know that. So when my mom calls and does, I was like, oh. So I eventually called my dad. Actually, at the time, I paged my dad. That we're talking, you know, back in the page days, right?
777.
Paged my dad and was like, he said, Dad, what's going on with mom? Like, she's really pissed off. She's really mad. Like, I don't know how to, like, handle this. Like, what's going on? Is everything okay? And he said, yeah, everything's okay. You know, she ran out of her medication. She's just really on edge right now, but we're going to get to the doctor and get her medication. So she had run out of her prescription medication and then got the refill. And I mean, her whole attitude changed. I mean, she was happy, so apologetic, remorseful, sent me this cute little card with a cat on it with like a scuba gear. It was like the cutest little card and such a loving card of like, I'm so sorry that I lashed out, you know, everything's going to be okay. We're going to get things in order. You know, you're not going, you know, you're going to continue at Rutgers. Everything's going to be great. And so just think about that. And I want to go back because this really ties back to what we opened up with, which is the sport of gymnastics, the perfect 10, the performance. And oh, by the way, compartmentalizing. From a very young age, I got really good at taking a performance, maybe a bad performance, boxing it up, putting it on a shelf and completely forgetting about it. Move on, right? It's next routine up every single time. So that's how you train. And I think I trained my brain, trained my body, trained my mind to take a terrible situation, box it up, stick it over here, moving on. So after that incident happened, a week before they died, I boxed it up. To me, everything was perfectly fine. And yet, little did I know that I was going to get that call from my dad in the middle of the night to tell me my mom died a week later.
Yeah. That's rough. So when did you start to put together the pieces that you had to go on a healing journey?
You know, It took about 7 years to even get to the place where I could actually like listen to my auntie Linda, my mom's sister, who very lovingly tried to share the truth about my parents. It took 7 years for me to allow her to say out loud, your mom and dad died of overdoses. Like 7 years. And then finally at about the 10-year mark is when I began to verbalize it myself. So, you know, slowly but surely, I started to open that door and finally looked at the toxicology reports and acknowledged those as truth, opened those up, saw what was in there. And I think that's when I started to really realize, okay, this is where the journey to healing begins. Because it was a heavy weight that I carried. It was painful to read those toxicology reports because let me tell you, I was scared out of my mind what I was going to find in there. Just because all of a sudden you have, somewhat elaborate details about what happened that night, more elaborate than anything I had known, sadly. But also, like, are there going to be photos in there? Like, what am I going to see? Is there going to be something that I didn't know about that's just going to be, like, a total shock? Like, I was terrified. But I think that journey to healing then continues, and that's when I found my voice in all of it. Because I realized at that point, okay, maybe my story matters, and maybe I just need to start being honest with myself and getting honest with others. And when I started doing that, I realized like, this might hurt for a moment. You might cringe for a moment, like as you go to say it, and then the response comes back to you, and you're like, oh, that wasn't so bad.
Right. Yep.
Right. And I think that's when I realized that people loved my parents just the same. When they found out they died of overdoses, They love them just the same, if not more, saying, wow, I wish I would have known. I wish I could have helped them. I wish I could have gone to bat for them. I wish I would have asked more questions. And, you know, there's always the should-haves. That's always going to be the case in life. But the overall resounding response was, we loved your parents so much, and we know they're so proud of you. Proud of you for the work you're doing, you know, the voice that you're carrying for others who've been silenced like they were. And, you know, I started to realize, and then just the stories, you know, about my parents, like people still love my parents just the same. And I'm like, So sometimes stepping into the truth really isn't as scary as it might seem.
Yeah. Unless we're talking about somebody who has hurt your life, like killed one of your relatives or caused you to lose your job or something like that. Unless it's that, people are very, very up for giving grace. People are very, very up for understanding, giving understanding. But when that stuff happens to us, we feel like, no, it's a scarlet letter on me. Oh, no, they think I did something wrong. There's a shame. That's one of the horrible thing about shame. I know you're a woman of faith, so I'll just kind of use this. You know, we all have an enemy, a spiritual enemy. The Bible calls him the devil, Satan, Lucifer. He's also known as the father of lies. And he will lie to us even on things that seem like shouldn't be a big deal, but no, it's a big deal. And he's going to tell you it's a big deal because he wants you separated from the life that God wants for you. And shame is a great way to do it.
Woo, let me tell you, you nailed it right there. You absolutely nailed it because—
Well, I am a preacher. I'm pretty good at that stuff.
I mean, preach.
It's my day job. I'm pretty good at the Bible, yeah.
I love it. Well, hey, I mean, but you nailed it right there. Yeah, because the enemy wants us in that darkness. The enemy wants us to isolate ourselves,
yes, right?
Right. And, you know, I have found in this journey that even still, the more I pipe up, the more the enemy comes to attack and tell me I'm less than. Imposter syndrome sets in. Like when I released this book, dude, let me tell you, I was just like, I mean, I delayed the launch of it like 4 times. I had a baby in the midst of all of it. So that, you know, I feel like that was a good excuse. But a lot of the other times were just because of fear. What are people going to say? Who cares what I got to say, you know? And I think that's exactly where the enemy wanted me to be, wanted me to feel less than, unworthy. Hey, your message doesn't really need to be out there. And that fear of rejection, right? And so the enemy definitely sent me down that spiral, because I'll tell you this, as a woman of faith, yes, because a lot of people do ask me, they're like, you know, where were you in your walk with faith when your parents died? And I felt like I was strong in my faith. I'm a million times stronger now, but that such is life, right? You know, I've now lived, you know, more than double what I was then at 18 years old. But I, you know, I was always you talk about the cheerleader. I was the rah-rah person in the house, right? When things would get challenging, hey, you know, like say our prayers, go to church, like God's got us. I was always that person in our household. But when my parents died, like, anger took over, and it was like, why would God abandon me in a moment like this? And then I always go back to, it was then that I carried you. My absolute favorite poem, Footprints in the Sand, used to read it all the
time.
Don't
say it. Say it ain't so. Footprints in the Sand.
Footprints in the Sand. Right.
I didn't know, actually. I thought most people just rolled their eyes at that one. That actually helped you. Good.
Oh, it helped me big, because I'll tell you this, like, I mean, no, because growing up, like in gymnastics, like I used to have these baseball card holders full of these inspirational cards. My mom would like go to Hallmark and they would have these like credit card size, like inspirational scripture, things like that. And Footprints in the Sand was one that I just latched onto. I had like photos around my room and the different sayings and posters and all the Footprints in the Sand. And so it was then that I carried you. And so I really leaned into that in my childhood, you know, in my gymnastics career. And then when it came down to it and I faced the absolute biggest slap in the face on the planet, gut punch, knock you down and kick you while you're down, I kind of did the all, I don't need your help. I'm good, right? Like I kind of did this whole pity party. I've got people to help me here, but And let me just do this on my own for a little while and see how it goes. So I never stopped believing in God, but I definitely, instead of leaning in, I did the old lean out.
Yeah. So 10 years after they died, that was a significant moment for you in your healing, which is when you said, hey, my parents died this way. That was that moment of truth. What other things, as you look back on it, were moments of clarity where you went, oh, something just happened here that was significant. Oh, something is, that's different. Do you have any other obvious ones?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was obviously big. And some other moments of clarity really came to me in my sports career because, you know, here I am, professional storyteller, and I literally had zero guts to tell my own story, you know? Interesting. You know, these people are coming to me to tell my story or tell their story as a reporter. And the number one thing that comes to mind is integrity when you're a reporter, like, right? You want to have integrity. So people would come to me to be a voice for them, to share their story. And then I see this ripple effect. And so then it's this aha moment. So then it's uncovering what happened, facing the truth, stepping into the truth. But now what are you going to do with it, Lauren? And I think that was another big aha moment for me. It was like, oh, my story does matter. And my story can be the very thing that unlocks my shackles of shame and gives permission to others to do the same. Because I think that we are all imprisoned by anxiety, fear, embarrassment, doubt. And those things will just have its grip on us if we allow it to.
Yeah. For sure.
So I think that's probably a big aha moment. And then I will say this, you know, kind of just going down this path with the book, you know, it was a long journey, 2.5 years of writing and, you know, exploring and investigating. This other big aha moment came to me, and it's just so cool. Like, you can't even script this out. It's wild. So I actually spoke at my high school in 2021, and there was an eighth grader there who went home to dad and said, hey, dad, the sports reporter from ESPN came and spoke to us today, and she shared her story, and he starts recounting my story. And his dad stopped him and said, son, I was the one that responded that day to that call.
Wow.
When her parents died. And here's the irony of it all. I was supposed to speak in 2020. My high school's 8th through 12th grade. 2020, this young man, Brady, would have been in 7th grade. So had COVID have not happened, I would have spoken to that school and Brady would not have been there and I never would have met Deputy Thwaites. Hmm. So like the cool part about it is like actually COVID ended up working in my favor big time. You know, can't make that one up. And so I met this deputy. I spent time with him and it was just this unbelievable. Let me tell you. Like we talked about Nick Saban earlier. I used to be so intimidated like by a lot of these coaches. Like I'd walk into a room and I just, my heart would start racing. I'd go to interview them and I'm just so intimidating. As I'm pulling up to the sheriff's department, I had literally never been so nervous in my life. Like I've interviewed some crazy people and been intimidated. I was so intimidated. And so there was an aha moment as I put my hands on the steering wheel. I could just feel my nerves just like, oh my gosh. And I think what it was is this connector to one of the darkest days of my life. I'm about to meet the man that walked into my house, my dad lying on the floor, you know, shortly after he had passed away. And he had been in my house and thinking like, wow, you know, but the power of that connection and so much that has come from it, so much that he uncovered, so much that he shared. And, you know, you ask about that whole five-hour journey of like your parents die of accidental overdoses, like what happened, like how do you even know this information? And a lot of it comes to light 19 years later because of that man, Deputy Thwaites, for him to be able to share that with me, to be able to help me to unpack what had happened that day. And the very thing that came to me that was just so profound is, you know, for many years, I always kind of wondered, you know, my mom died of an accidental overdose. And, you know, she had packed a cooler. She had painted her nails that night. There were a lot of indicators that, like, they were not planning to take their lives. This was not supposed to happen. And then in the back of my mind, there was still always that thought of like my dad, and, you know, he's distraught, he's sad. He, you know, there's a lot to unpack there. And I'm thinking, you know, did my dad take his life? And so there was a lot of hurt and maybe just like curiosity there. But the deputy told me, Eric Thwaites told me, he said, Lauren, there was a point in time where when we walked in that house, we all thought it was suicide. But knowing what I know now, he worked on the drug task force for many years. And then he said to me, he said, Lauren, your dad died with the phone in his hands, doing everything he could to get you and your brother home. To me, that's not indicative of a man that was ready to leave this earth. And, you know, that to me was very profound because, again, I'll never know all the answers, but it was also a big aha moment for me because as I'm unpacking all these things, trying to find answers that I never thought I'd ever get, here I am 19 years later, still getting answers and really finding peace in all of it and healing. And this has been such a healing journey. And I think for me, taking that almost leap to say, all right, I'm going to go deep on this. I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to walk through these very traumatic events, uncover the things that happened, open up some deep, deep wounds, and I'm going to go there. And for me, it has been just an incredible journey. And I'm grateful for it because it's taken me a long time to get here, but there's so much that I've learned in the process that I'm very grateful for.
Her name is Lauren Sisler. The book is called Shatterproof. And thanks, Lauren, for letting us see how to overcome some shame that a bunch of us deal with. So well done, good and faithful servant. And thanks for sharing your story and sharing your smile. And you haven't shared your shimmy yet today, but that's okay. I got enough other places to see it.
Only if you'll do it with me.
All right. Hey, this has been great. Hey, why don't you do something, everybody? Everybody, you've probably got something you're dealing with. Lauren's given us a lot of great cues. Go ahead, pick it up, get out there, and start changing your life. Lauren, anything else you want to add?
I love it. My mantra in life, fall in love with your story. When you can learn to fall in love with your story, every single chapter, the good and the hard, you are going to unlock the shackles of shame and find freedom that you never knew was possible. So I just want to encourage you. You're holding on to it. Go there. Doesn't have to be in front of a million people. Maybe it's your neighbor, your best friend, somebody at church, just whoever. Maybe it's even the cashier at the checkout line, whatever it is. But when you can step into your story, own the truth, and know that your story is the very thing, the adversity that you face is the very thing that is not going to define you, but refine you and make you stronger. Lean into that, my friends.
We'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life. Man Camp 2025 is just around the corner, October 17th and 19th in Southwest Ohio. Thousands of men from all over the literal world are going to be descending on our property, connecting with each other, having fun, laughing, connecting with God, stretching ourselves, pushing ourselves, playing all sorts of things. It's really going to be phenomenal. And this year, man, we have some new things we're doing this year that I want to make sure that you're in on. First off, Bear Grylls, world-renowned survivalist camper, Bear Grylls is going to be with us. He's going to be great. Dante Bow, Grammy Award-winning artist. Dante is going to be there with us, helping us out with worship. It is going to be an amazing three-day experience. Get off the grid. Push yourself. Try something new. Form some bonds. Form some relationships. Have some hangout time. Have some laughter. We get all that and a lot, lot more at Man Camp. I've got a 15% discount off code for you if you enter podcast15 at checkout, podcast15. You can claim your spot right now and do it quickly at mancamp.us. And then invite someone to come with you, and I'll be looking forward to you there. Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and more at briantome.com. My new book, a 60-day devotional called The 5 Marks of a Man, 60 Days to a Powerful Life, along with all the other books in the 5 Marks library, are open right now on Amazon. Be sure to leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Then send an email to dirt, that's dirt, at briantome.com to get a free Aggressive Life sticker. Find more on Instagram at briantome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.